Welcome to The Point. It's our news roundup, our weekly news roundup, when we discuss some of the top news stories of the week with my colleagues in the print and digital media. I'm Sean Corcoran. Joining me here in our Woods Hole studio is George Brennan. He's a reporter with the Cape Cod Times. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Sean.
And joining us a little later will be Tim Wood, the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Sally Rose will call in. She's the editor of the Provincetown Banner. And I expect we'll hear from Nelson Siegelman, the managing editor at the Martha's Vineyard Times. So let's take a look at some of the news here on the Cape and the islands, and let's start with an issue we've been following for months, and barring any legal action, which may indeed come, it's an issue that appears to be settled. George, I'm talking about the proposal to build a Lowe's store in Dennis. There was a vote last night.
That's right, and this vote came after a six-hour hearing before the Cape Cod Commission. Ultimately, the commissioners voted 8-6 against siting a Lowe's in Dennis. There was a lot of spirited debate back and forth, as there has been since this project was proposed initially this past summer. It's gone back and forth. There's been different iterations, people putting up signs, very passionate, writing letters to the editor, you name it. There's been no lack of opinions on either side of this issue. Selectmen and Dennis seeing it as a way to get more revenue, mm-hmm. more jobs. And opponents saying it would hurt small business, places like True Value Hardware Shops and Mid-Cape Center, local businesses. So Lowe's has tried many different things to appease some of the opponents. They've lowered the overall square footage of the store, and it just didn't come to be. One of the store officials was asked by our reporter last night, so are you going to take legal action? And he said that's going to be up to the corporate bigwigs to decide.
Certainly, they've gone through this before. I mean, there were many years back in the 90s where reporters were constantly writing about these big box stores trying to come into communities, huge push back against them. But typically, they I covered a half dozen of these, and they usually made it in. So this was somewhat of a surprise to me. But as you mentioned, you know, 2,500 documents submitted. This was a real controversy. What did the commission come down and actually say was their reason for rejecting it?
I think it had to do with the, protecting the small businesses.
Right.
You know, and as you said, you know, in other communities, there have been these controversies over big box stores. Nowhere near what we've had here on the Cape, though, I don't think. Over the years, we have a running tally in the paper of we termed it the big box scorecard. And, you know, you see places like Falmouth Walmart initially had been rejected by the Cape Cod Commission in 1993. And then Sam's Club in Hyannis was rejected. And what typically has had to happen for these big box retailers to come into Cape Cod is to find another store that's gone out of business. The Walmart, for example, in Falmouth is in an old Bradley's store.
Oh.
And I think the same is true of the Home Depot in Hyannis. That's in a retailer that went out of business. Maybe even a Bradley's, if I'm not mistaken. So that's what's had to happen. And, you know, perhaps had Lowe's found a place in Dennis or in that area big enough, maybe they could have proposed it that way.
And as we mentioned at the top, there's the potential for them to take it to the courts, and you never know what's going to come out of that. Let's talk about last week's storm. You know, while it didn't appear to cause major damage to the Cape and the islands on a broad scale, there are certainly some damaged areas around the region that will now need to be fixed, and some of them we're familiar with because they were damaged last year.
That's right. I mean, all eyes were on Chatham and Sandwich as this storm was coming. Nor'easters traditionally have hurt both of those coastal towns really hard, particularly last winter. And there was concern because there were a couple of high tides in this storm to watch. Both of those communities fared better than expected, but there was some significant damage, for example, in Dennis near Chapin Beach. A road was destroyed, or part of a road was destroyed and has to be rebuilt. A road, you know, that in that storm last year, last February, was also destroyed, that particular portion of it. They're worried that if they don't fix it, that the whole road could go in a follow-up storm. You know, we're very early in this season. They have the same concerns over in Sandwich at Town Neck Beach. There was significant erosion, not as bad as they anticipated. They did some work ahead of the storm, put up a temporary a sand wall, mm-hmm. so to speak, and that kind of held. But some of the properties lost significant amount of sand in front of their homes, and you know they're now worried about what the next storm might bring.
Yeah, Doug Frazier had a great story in the paper. I think it might have been Sunday. It might have been Monday. I'm not sure.
But it was Sunday.
It was Sunday where they interviewing people who have lived there for decades, just talking about how they could never see the water when they first moved in, and slowly they've gotten this water view, and now they're getting really close to the water. Just a really well-researched story there.
It's amazing. You know, they talked about how the dunes were there, and some of the beach amenities that were there in Sandwich at the time, you know, when their families first started coming there. And, you know, there was a lot of debate at a recent town meeting about why doesn't Sandwich have a concession stand and facilities at their beach? And Bud Dunham, who's the town manager, he said, look, we're not going to spend $500,000 on a nice facility that's in the way of waves at this point. They're still working on getting permit to restore their dunes at the beach and do a whole beach management plan. And until they get that, he doesn't want to see the town invest any more money in facilities because he's afraid it'll just get washed away.
Well, Sandwich also has the issue. They're concerned about a jetty that has been built closer over to the canal, and they say if that wasn't there, they would be getting the sand, the beaches replenished. Is that right?
That's right. The irony is over on the Scusset beach side of Sandwich, there's too much sand, and those jetties are preventing the sand from going into the canal. That's a good thing. The Army Corps doesn't want their Cape Cod Canal to be clogged with sand. But at the same time, those jetties that are preventing the sand from going into the canal, experts say that that's preventing or starving the beaches at Town Neck and further along Cape Cod from getting the renourishment that they need.
And in other regions, because of the storm, I think it's Mance Landing and Brewster was still barricaded after the parking lot was inundated with seawater during that Friday storm. And at Nauset Light Beach in Eastham, spectators they had to look out over those breakers from the parking lot, basically, because the bottom of the stairway to that beach was swept away. So there was some damage for sure, and I think they're still trying to figure that out, how they're going to take care of those areas. Let's move on. I want to talk about a turbine ruling here in Falmouth. We've talked a lot about the town-owned wind turbines in Falmouth. Some residents have complained of health effects from those turbines, from the noise or from what they call infrasound from those turbines. And it's ended up, of course, a lot of disagreement in the town itself, and it's also been in the courts. So we have a new lawsuit now to talk about.
Yeah, we have a second lawsuit, and again, it's the town suing itself. The town, meaning the selectmen, are suing the zoning board. The zoning board in December ruled that the turbines near the wastewater treatment plant here in town are disruptive to Barry and Diane Funfar, and that those turbines are causing problems for those property owners and are disruptive to them. Of course, there's already a lawsuit going on, and during the pendency of that case, the judge has ruled that the turbines have to stay off on certain holidays, Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's Day, and they can only run between 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. So this case is already ongoing. Now there's another legal case, another legal fight, and you know where it all winds up. We're all going to just have to sit back and watch.
But this isn't common to have a town suing one town board suing it another town board.
No, I mean it's not unprecedented, but it's unusual to see this. Usually, you would see the boards trying to work these types of things out, but certainly there's a difference of opinion on how to proceed here. I mean, I think the selectmen have acknowledged that there is some sort of a issue here.
Oh, yeah.
But it's they have another issue that they have to deal with, and that's they're beholden to the taxpayers of the town, and they've tried to find ways to deal with the issues. Town meeting, as you know, and town voters didn't want to pay the price that it would take down the turbines.
Sure, that election that was held last year, the voters were asked, "Are you willing to spend the money to take these turbines down?" And it was pretty clear the voters aren't willing to spend the money to take them down.
So right.
Let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk to Tim Wood, the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle in Chatham. We'll talk about some things happening there, and we'll also talk about the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Plant. And welcome back. This is the News Roundup on WCAI, when we discuss the top news stories of the week. I'm Sean Corcoran, and with me in our Woods Hole studio is George Brennan, a reporter at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. And I want to go back to the Falmouth wind turbines issue that we were just talking about real quick, because there is a story in today's paper about a new study related to home values. So, George, one of the issues that residents raise is, with all the concerns about the turbines, how am I going to be able to sell my home? Who wants to come in here? But this report kind of debunks that.
That's right. This was done by the Clean Energy Center, which is a quasi-public agency, promotes clean energy technology. And what they found, they said, is that it doesn't affect home prices. They did a study looking at properties between 1998 and 2012 that were within 5 miles of 41 wind turbines in Massachusetts, and they say that it had the effect of about half a percent in the positive direction, they say. But opponents aren't buying it. They say, look who did the study. The state, which wants, you know, through Governor Deval Patrick, they've said that they want to expand wind energy in the state. And so they're saying that they don't believe that this is a complete study. One of the homeowners talked to us, and he said he had an appraisal done on his house. When he didn't include the wind turbine, his house appraised at $714,000. Add in the wind turbine, and the property value went down to $429,000. Pretty significant drop. So, maybe an independent study at some point would appease people, but at this point, I don't think it's going to end the controversy.
No, probably not. But you also can't just look at a study and say, oh, well, here's who it's from. It can't be legitimate. I mean, you actually have to look at how they did the study and point to legitimate problems. And maybe that will happen. Maybe there hasn't been enough time to really study the study itself. But you got to wonder, that's looking at all these turbines. What if you just looked at those turbines here in Falmouth? I mean, most of the turbines around the state haven't received the publicity, or maybe they don't have the complaints, probably not, that we have here in Falmouth. In Falmouth, everyone knows about what's happening in that neighborhood.
Right. And water issues, if there's beaches nearby, that affects property values, and that could have an effect to keep, these turbines are in West Falmouth. They're not far from the beaches. That could be helping to keep the property values up,
Oh, sure.
Maybe worth a study here.
Yeah, maybe. Absolutely. Let's bring Tim Wood in on this morning's conversation. He's the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. How are you, Tim?
I'm fine, Sean. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk about efforts to save a mural at Harwich High School that will be lost or would be lost when the school is demolished.
Yeah, potentially. Back in 1964, Harwich artist Milton Welt painted a huge mural on the wall of the lobby of what was then a brand new Harwich High School. It depicted all the Harwich iconic scenes, Cranberry Bogs, Brooks Academy, Witchmere Harbor. And for decades, students came and went, and that mural was always there to greet them. Well, the school, as you said, is slated to be demolished later this year when the new Monomoy Regional High School opens. Harwich officials are trying to figure out how they can save that mural. And it's a very complicated process because the mural is actually attached to the cinder block wall. And They've gotten one estimate from a preservation company to remove and restore the mural to another location, maybe the elementary school. The estimate is $170,000. And right now, the school system is fighting a budget battle with the town, so they don't have the money. These Harwich residents and officials are hoping to band together to create some kind of a fundraising effort to somehow save the mural. If they can't actually take the mural off, another option they've looked at is creating a high-resolution digital copy of the mural and then transposing it somewhere else. They're in the early stages of this, but they don't really have a lot of time because the demolition is going to happen over the summer. So they've kind of got to get moving on this.
Well, as you were talking, that was the first idea that came to my mind. Take some pictures. They now print things out the size of walls that you can adhere. Right. Something. Any cost estimates related to that?
I think they had an initial estimate of anywhere from $3,000 to $10,000 to do that. So that's kind of pricey, too, but I would think that's a little more manageable than $170,000.
Yeah. Interesting. This must happen all the time with schools, you'd think.
You would think. You know, how many schools have murals in them that have been painted by students, or in the case of this one, Milton Welt was a very well-known Harwich artist, and he was a selectman in town, too, a couple of years ago, but he was very much a part of Harwich, so therefore this mural has even more ties to the town than just what's shown on it.
Tim, George Brennan and I were talking about some of the damage from the storm. There were also some damage at North Beach Island or the camps there?
Yeah, but over on North Beach Island out across Chatham Harbor, there were five beach camps out there that are left. Back in 2012, the National Seashore, you may remember, demolished five of the camps that were out there. That was pretty controversial.
Yeah,
they said they were doing it to prevent them from washing away in a storm. Well, in this last blizzard, one of the remaining camps had some of the understory, which was like cribbing it was up on, washed away by the high tide that really washed across the island in many places. And so the house is sort of now teetering on a couple house jacks and some more cribbing. In this case, the owners, the Schluter and Gould families, had already started the process of to demolish the camp because they had pretty much known that they weren't going to be able to hold on to it much longer. They couldn't afford to put it on substantial pilings like the other four camps that are remaining are sitting on. That was going to cost $100,000. They didn't want to do that. So this past, just after Christmas, the families went out. They took out all their personal goods and kind of said their goodbyes to this camp that they've owned for 35 years, and they anticipate that when there's a substantial break in the weather here, their contractor will be going out to the island to take the camp down.
So do they have to pay? They have to pay for that. The family has to pay for
they
that.
They do have to pay for that. That's on their dime to take the camps down.
Right.
Take that camp down, and it leaves four more camps. There used to be I think 11 or 12 out there in this particular grouping that was on what is now North Beach Island, which used to be part of North Beach but was separated in 2007 when a new inlet was formed out there.
Yep.
It's all part of this, you know, the cyclical erosion and accretion of the barrier beaches out here. So it's not unexpected, but it's very painful when, you know, there's a lot of memories out there from 35 years.
Oh, of course. Let's talk about Skydive Cape Cod and what's happening with that at the airport. Very controversial, that organization.
Yeah, very controversial. It's always a sure topic to generate a lot of letters to the editor. Back in November, the Board of Selectmen kind of indicated that they didn't want the operator, the manager of the airport, to renew the contract for the Skydive Cape Cod operation that runs out of Chatham Airport, and the contract was up at the end of December. The town manager is the one with the authority not to renew the contract, and she sort of indicated she would follow the selectman's lead on this. But there's been no contract renewal document in place for her to deny, basically. So this past week, the airport operator went before the airport commission with a three-year renewal for Skydive Cape Cod's contract to operate at the airport. The airport commission unanimously approved it, which was a very unpopular decision with the opponents of Skydive. But the airport commission said their hands are kind of tied. They have to approve it. It's up to the town manager to, at the next level, to deny or approve that renewal. And the town, in the meantime, has sought some input from the FAA as to whether they legally can get an exemption to deny skydiving at the airport under federal regulations. Airports that accept federal grants, such as the Chatham one, there's been over $6 million in grant money there just in the past decade or so, are required to allow general aviation activities such as skydiving unless they get an exemption, which can only be granted under certain circumstances. And they're pursuing that now, and the FAA has pretty much told the town, you can't deny this contract, you can't deny this activity at the airport without an investigation and our approval, and that has not come through yet.
Okay, so that issue continues.
No doubt.
Tim Wood is the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Thank you very much, Tim. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Sean.
George Brennan is with me in our Woods Hole studio. George, I want to talk briefly about a Pilgrim nuclear power station. We heard more about Pilgrim possibly even being more troubled, or at least on a list of more troubled turbines.
Right. Well, there was a required report that came out this week on some shutdown that they had last year. But the number of shutdowns that they had, unexpected shutdowns, is expected to put them in the category of one of the eight worst performing reactors in the country, according to the NRC, when that report comes out. And it's due, it's their fourth quarter analysis, and it's due out by the end of this month or early next month. So we'll be hearing more then.
Okay. Let's go to Nelson Siegelman. He joins us on the phone. Nelson is the managing editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Hello, Nelson.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Let's talk about Steve James, the death of Steve James. And, of course, he was the organizer of the Oak Bluffs Monster Shark Tournament, which has been both beloved and controversial on the vineyard over time.
Sure. It was, well, certainly, you know, just speaking about his death, it's a tragedy. Two men dead, one was brought to the hospital. He apparently will survive. They were duck hunting in the Westport River on a pretty blustery day. And Steve James was a controversial figure on the vineyard, but I think that the tournament that he ran for 27 years was much better known than Steve James himself. He presided over the tournament and the weigh-ins when every July, and he was sort of the ring, you know, the ringleader there, the ringmaster, if you will, and it was always quite a scene. Last year it was a little bit tamer. They only brought a dozen sharks to the weigh station. There were a couple of hundred people lining the harbor, but in years past it would be just a real circus. Hundreds of people, huge sharks weighed in, and for those who liked the spectacle, it was great fun. And for those who were against killing sharks, it was a real horror. So that generated quite a bit of controversy over, you know, in recent years on the vineyard.
Right. And James had spoken a lot about, you know, moving the tournament. He bristled at some new regulations and fees.
Yes. Last fall, he indicated he was considering doing that because the Oak Bluff Selectmen added a number of fees on to the tournament. They had to pay additional amounts of money per boat, and this was done to mitigate the cost of public safety services. They had extra EMTs on, they had extra police on, and that stemmed really from the previous year when the PA Club held its annual Portuguese feast and the shark tournament. That coincided on one weekend, and there were a number of arrests, mostly disturbing the peace, public drunkenness, that sort of thing. But Steve James, who was never shy about expressing his opinion about anything, bristled at the notion that the fishermen who participated in the tournament were being taxed for something he thought they didn't really create. And he often went head-to-head with protesters over the notion of shark tournaments, maintaining that they ran a very good tournament. And in fact, last year, only a dozen sharks were brought to the weigh station. So,
George Brennan, you want to chime in?
One of the things about Steve James is he was definitely the face and the voice of this tournament, very passionate about it. And we don't know who the successor is out there. There was never a number two guy. It was always Steve James, you know, talking about the tournament, what to do next with the tournament, whether he was going to move it, keep it in Oak Bluffs, and also fighting back against folks like PETA and things like that. So we're not sure where this tournament is headed.
Nelson, any clarity on the future of the tournament at all?
No, but my guess would be that it will disappear. You're absolutely right. He was the guy, and you know, I've organized a few small fishing tournaments, and I know that it's an incredible amount of work. I can't imagine the amount of work that went into this, because we're talking about, in some cases, more than 100 boats. These are very large boats. You had to arrange to have room for them in the harbor. You had to provide a venue for the award ceremony. It's just a lot of work, and in some ways, it's got to be a labor of love. You have to really enjoy doing it, because I can't imagine that it was much of a moneymaker. So my guess is that the shark tournament has probably run its course, and mm-hmm. that will please some people, and for others it will come as a great disappointment.
Nelson, you wrote an essay this week about an experience in Woods Hole. Why don't you tell us a little bit about
yeah.
that?
Yeah, the internet harpies are all over me for that, it seems, which is kind of fun to see the comments. But, my wife and I decided to go off-island, which is something we don't do as often as we probably should. Usually it's for not for fun. But at any rate, we pulled up next to the Vineyard branch of the Martha's Vineyard Bank in Woods Hole, and I pulled into a parking spot next to a meter. The snow's blowing. The wind is whipping the snow around. And when I came out, I was surprised to see a police car behind my vehicle. My wife was sitting in it. The engine was running, and the policeman had his window down. I saw that he was jotting in a book, and I said, "Are you writing me a parking ticket?" Which, in fact, he was. And so I wrote about our conversation and really just the notion that when you're on the vineyard, if I were on the vineyard, I'd expect the cop, if I was doing something like that, he might come up and say, "Look, if you're going to sit here with the engine running, you've got to put money in the meter, or, you know, you've got to move." I wouldn't expect him to come up, say nothing to my wife, and start writing a ticket, which is what this fellow did. And apparently, according to my wife, he had done the same thing just before he came up to my car. Some people were in a vehicle. He saw them. There wasn't money in the meter, wrote a ticket, and then handed it to him. It just seemed like something that shouldn't be occurring on a January day in Woods Hole. But I guess other people think was a perfectly fine thing for him to do. It was a fun thing to write, and the internet commenters can have at me.
Well, I'd like to send some more your way, so people can go to the Martha's Vineyard Times to read about your experience.
Have
have at Nelson Siegelman. Nelson, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Okay, we'll talk to you later. Let's go right to Sally Rose. She's the editor of the Provincetown Banner. Sally, you there?
Yes. Hi, Sean.
How are you? Let's talk about affordable housing, big issue in Provincetown. But I'm wondering, has the affordable housing issue gotten better over the past 10 years? Has there been any improvement?
Well, interesting. I guess the answer to that is yes and no. in the last couple of years, Provincetown added two affordable rental developments, and that totaled 65, excuse me, I have a cold, so pardon my voice.
Well, that's okay.
Totaled 65 affordable rental units. That was 50 units at Province Landing and another 15 units up the road at 83 Shankpainer. So with those, the town actually met the state's requirement for affordable housing, or 10% of its housing stock.
That's huge. That's extremely significant. Most
it
communities
really is.
Cannot
right.
get there. Yeah.
Right. But now, just recently, a housing consultant just informed the town that despite that, Provincetown's housing crisis has indeed worsened. The consultant, John Ryan, he's based in Amherst. He did a housing report for the town back in 2006, and he was recently asked to do an update, which he just turned in last month. He's saying that one of the key culprits is condominium conversion. He says that there have been 376 condo units created since fiscal year 2007, and most of those were small multifamily properties before they were converted to condos, and many of those units serve as second homes in Provincetown. So it means that the loss of multifamily rental units to condo conversion has outpaced the production of new rental units. Relatively few of those new condos are then in turn being offered as year-round rentals.
Now, this was a big thing in the 80s and the 90s, all these condos coming about. I was told in the mid-2000s that no one thought there was any place else you could even condoize, but almost 400 more since in the last
compared to the 65 affordable rental units. And I guess a lot of those, another thing the report also said was that the concentration of renters, and I think this is taking place everywhere, all over the Cape, but the concentration of renters paying more than 35% of their income for rent has gone from 44% back in 2000 to nearly 60% in 2010. So all of these discussions, these issues are being discussed today during a housing summit in Provincetown, and I guess town leaders are hoping to brainstorm solutions with all the participants, renters, owners, seasonal and year-round residents, and workers and employers. They're hoping will show up for it today.
Right. Certainly the employers could have a key role to play here as well. All right, Sally, thank you very much for the update, and we appreciate it.
Thank you, Sean.
George Brennan is with me here in our Woods Hole studio. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk casinos with George Brennan. That's the issue he covers for the Cape Cod Times, one of the many issues he covers there. And we'll also talk about an elephant. And welcome back to the News Roundup on WCAI. I'm Sean Corcoran, and with me in our Woods Hole studio is George Brennan. He's a reporter at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online, and one of the issues he covers there extensively is the casino push here in Massachusetts. Certainly we have the Wampanoag of Mashpee who are attempting to get a casino themselves. George, we've just heard from a federal judge this week about the Massachusetts casino issue. What did he have to say?
Yeah, this ruling just came down yesterday afternoon. It was widely anticipated ruling, and he came down on the side of the state. He said that the state law is not unconstitutional. KG Urban Enterprises, they're a private developer. They want to build a casino in New Bedford. And the day Governor Patrick put the ink on the casino law, they filed a federal lawsuit saying that the preference in that law for federally recognized tribes like the Mashpee Wampanoag was unconstitutional, that it was a race-based set-aside is how they put it, and that it shouldn't be in the United States, that it violated the U.S. Constitution. This has been going on since then. It initially was dismissed by the same judge in February of 2012. KG Urban appealed to the First Circuit. First Circuit judge came back and said that the amount of time that the state could give the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe had to be limited, but the judge didn't say for how long.
Oh, so that would be left to the legislature or the commission? Or
It was put in the commission's hands.
Uh-huh.
And last June, the commission opened up Region C, which is what Southeastern Mass is referred to in the legislation. They opened that up to commercial bidders. They accepted bids through September 30th. KG Urban was the only commercial bidder to file an application at that point. And their application is currently under review in the first phase. And in the first phase, it's background checks of the key players. Now, KG Urban is saying they'd like to have a financial investor, but with the Mashpee Wampanoag out there looming as a potential competitor in the region, they're having trouble. They're struggling to get a financial investor to come on board. The Mashpee Wampanoag has gotten some momentum recently. Last week, the compact was approved by the Federal Bureau of Indian Affairs. That's a key step, not the only step. They have a land application that's also under review, more complicated, a lot of legal tangles there. The tribe leaders say, we're going to get through this. Mm. And they believe they can get a shovel in the ground this year.
Wow. So that contract that was approved last week, that's the contract between the Commonwealth and the tribe that sets up what the rates are going to be in terms of taxes and just how it'll all work?
Right. A federal Indian casino can't be taxed. They have to agree to provide revenue to the state and in exchange for something. And what they got in exchange is some exclusivity in the region. Now, if a commercial casino is built in the same region that they're in, they don't have to pay the state anything under this compact. If there are casinos in other parts of the state, they pay 17% to the state. So the state obviously wants some of the revenue from an Indian casino.
You know, this casino issue was passed at a time where the state was really struggling, as most states were, as we were in the Great Recession, as it was called at the time. Has there been any indication among lawmakers or the public at large that support for this issue has waned as we enter into more prosperous times?
You know, it's interesting. Governor Patrick does a monthly radio show, and he was
asked, WGBH, actually.
And he was asked about it, and he said he's sick of the issue, which was pretty interesting at that time, because he was the one who pushed for it initially. It was the first thing out of the gate. He was talking about casinos for job growth and revenue. And on that show, he called it entertainment. And a lot of opponents, you know, really latched onto that. They're pushing, opponents are now, for a repeal of the law. They say that once people saw what casinos would bring to Massachusetts, that they don't want it. And they believe that they've built significant momentum to get that passed in November. They still have some hurdles to get over in order to fully get it on the ballot, but they got their initial amount of signatures on a petition. They have to overcome a legal challenge by the Attorney General, but it could be on the ballot and it could be binding.
Hmm. Let's talk about another issue that was in the paper this week regarding Provincetown and methamphetamines, crystal meth out there. We know about the drug problem on the Cape and the islands and the South Coast regarding OxyContin-like pills, painkiller pills, and that was born out of out of that came this increase in heroin use that was completely unexpected, I think. Now we're hearing about meth.
That's right.
It's swept across the country from the West and now is alive and well here in the Northeast.
Right. A bigger problem, as you said, in the West, in Midwest, but a particularly issue in gay communities. And this particular detective that we spoke to for this story, Casey Myers did the story, as she has with so many of the drug issues here on the Cape on Cape Cod. She delved into this one, and the detective we talked to said that it's cropping up here more and more. There was a big arrest in October, man arrested for and charged with drug trafficking. 99 grams of methamphetamine. And apparently meth has certain appeal to gay men because it increases sex drive. And, you know, it's a dangerous combination for them.
Well, the quote that really jumped out for me for the story was, you know, someone talking about people walking around town like zombies, that it's not difficult to point out who is addicted to meth.
That's right. It's taken a deep and troubling toll on the community. There are people, you know, they lose their jobs, they lose their focus, they lose their cars, their houses, and you know, we talked earlier about the affordable housing issue in Provincetown, and you know, this may be part of the issue. You know, you have people who are having difficulty keeping their jobs, not just because there aren't jobs, but because they're addicted to drugs.
Hmm. In Yarmouth news this week about a pretty well-known site, the site of the former Cavalier Motor Lodge, and they have some cottages there. may actually be demolished to make way for a new proposal. And this is something Yarmouth has worked really hard on over the years, to really improve upon some of these what are sometimes called eyesore sites along particularly Route 28, where many tourists travel, and you look and there's just vacant buildings. But Yarmouth has really pushed. They had some new some zoning changes. And now what's happening with this proposal?
Well, a couple of years ago, motels like the Cavalier were being used for housing illegally. The owners were renting them out to people for as if they were apartments, and you know, it was a really bad strain. But it took having the owners evict the people. It wasn't as if, you know, they could go in and clean them out. They had to go through the eviction process.
Sure.
And so now there's a developer who wants to take this property, wants to turn it into 72-bedroom apartments and a retail complex as well that would attract tourists going by on Route 28 in as well. And 35 of these are guaranteed to be affordable housing. The total cost of the project is $8.4 million. The developer is asking for a significant buy-in by the town, so to speak, mm-hmm. Through community preservation funds, which are available for affordable housing. They're looking for $3.2 million. They already got some money for this project, and they're looking for $2.4 million more in the upcoming election cycle or town meeting cycle. And you know, remains to be seen. This hinges on grants as well. Turning around a place that had become, you know, one of those places along Route 28 that, you know, you wanted to just drive past quickly.
Right. And community developers really look to these types of projects. Of course, this project could be a ways off. As you talk about, there's some grants that are contingent upon this this is contingent upon receiving some grants. But developers, community development people really like to see a mix of some commercial and some residential, some rentals, so people can actually go and get to stores, can get to things without having to park and travel and all of that.
And without having public transportation as well. You know?
Right, which is certainly another issue we have here on the Cape. Okay, so let's move on to another story about, I love this story, you know, the Dateline is out of Provincetown, but really we're talking about an elephant that is based in New Bedford, an elephant that has been known in the state for a long time, decades, and has had quite a history here.
That's right. This elephant is Ruth, and it's kind of a sad story.
Sure.
In a way. You know, Ruth was owned by a person, and she was brought down to Provincetown in the 80s and participated in the Provincetown carnival parades down there, beloved for her antics. Turned out she ended up getting abused, you know, and
right.
She was underweight and skittish and nervous when she was when animal cruelty officials found her in I think it was New Hampshire, and they took her away from that owner, and she was turned over to a zoo. It was the Southwick Wild Animal Farm.
Mm-hmm.
That owner went in and was able to somehow. How do you steal an elephant? But
yeah, he stole his elephant back.
Yeah, stole the elephant back. Abandoned her in a cramped trailer and found again.
Yeah, in Danvers.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, and so now she lives a pretty good life at Buttonwood Park Zoo, and.
Well, that might be arguable, but here comes the part of the story that we like. Those folks in Provincetown never forgot Ruth the elephant.
That's right. And, you know, what they've done now is they've collected Christmas trees. And I'll say I learned something from this story. I didn't know that elephants liked to play with Christmas trees, but apparently not only they do, but other zoo animals do as well. And so they've collected 50 used Christmas trees that they're going to deliver by truck to Ruth. and the other animals at Buttonwood Park Zoo in New Bedford to play with.
Well, Brian Morris, our reporter here, he was all set to travel along with the Christmas trees, follow the truck, and see Ruth enjoy those trees in New Bedford. But I guess the truck is broken down and is being repaired. So we're going to have to wait for that story. It might have to wait till Monday. It might come earlier, but we will be following the trees as they make their way to Ruth. Let's talk about the county and a plan to go another direction and figure out how, with county government here. So there's folks looking at how we can improve the county government.
That's right. This is one of those issues that's been around for a while again. There's a charter review committee that has been looking at different proposals. They've looked at, you know, whether there should be just a bigger county commission. They've looked at other issues. And now comes a possible proposal to have, so to speak, a mayor of Cape Cod, someone who would look out for all 15 communities here on Cape Cod, be an elected administrator, so to speak, for the whole Cape. And this is going to be presented to the Assembly of Delegates, who would make the decision of whether to move forward with this. It would be an appointed executive with a 11-member legislative panel as well.
When it comes to the county government, they're primarily doing dealing with development issues and zoning issues and those types of things.
That's right. They oversee the Cape Cod Commission, and also, but there's the Sheriff's Department as well, the court system, those types of things. So
we'll pay attention to that. And I also want to quickly talk about the commuter rail in Bourne, I guess. The town of Bourne is getting ready and hopeful that the commuter rail could extend to there. And, of course, a lot of talk about rail these days since the Cape Flyer, that tourist train that was operating on the weekends this past year in the summertime, was such a success.
Yeah, well, Tom Cahir, who is behind this, says it's directly related to the popularity of the Cape Flyer, that weekend tourist train. He says that the iron is finally hot for Bourne. He'd like to see, commuter rail come to Buzzards Bay. He tried this when he was in the legislature. There wasn't a lot of support for it at that time, but he believes at this point that it could work, that it could really be a boon to Main Street in Buzzards Bay, which has fallen on hard times because the highway went around it. And, it could help the restaurants and other businesses and hotels and motels in Buzzards Bay. And also he mentioned something. He said, we have Mass Maritime Academy there, and the cadets could hop on the train and head up to the city on the weekends.
We were talking just a little while ago about the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe, and there's a story coming up on Sunday in the Cape Cod Times that you're doing about the tribe's former leader, Glenn Marshall.
That's right. There's a new book out, and it's called Restoring Valor, and it's by Doug Sterner and his wife, Pam. And the two of them are the key people who helped expose the military lies that were told by Glenn Marshall, that he had served at the Battle of Khe San, that he had 5 Purple Hearts.
Yeah, and the irony was he was a Vietnam veteran. He just wasn't there at the time he said he was there.
That's right. My interview with Doug Sterner for this story, he says, that's what he finds with so many of the people who fake military valor, is that they served in the military, but it just wasn't enough for them. For whatever reason, it just having served in the military, which a lot of people respect, wasn't enough. They had to fake having medals as well.
George Brennan's story about that book coming out, Restoring Valor, will be in the Sunday Cape Cod Times. Thanks, George, reporter for the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online, for coming in today. Appreciate
Thank you.
Thanks to our other contributors, Tim Wood and the Cape Cod Chronicle, Nelson Siegelman, and Sally Rose calling in. I want to thank you for listening. I'm Sean Corcoran.